Hello and welcome to the 17th episode of 5 July podcast, as we call it in English, because this is the first English episode that we do, a sort of pilot episode.
An experiment.
Yes, I am Carl Andersson, and my friend here is Henrik Alexandersson, also called Hax.
Yep.
And there's a reason why we switched to English in this episode. Previous episodes were in Swedish. The reason is that I went to Mozilla's View Source conference in Berlin this week. That is also why we release this episode on a Thursday instead of Tuesdays when we usually publish. So at the end of this episode, we will have some interviews from the View Source conference, and it is a developer conference and design conference, a front-end developer conference. So anyway, we will start by doing what we do every week, which is to comment on what has happened in the area of privacy politics in the EU and in the world. So Hax, I think that there's one main theme for this episode, which is we have talked about it before. It's the big EU copyright reform, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you give me some coffee, I can gear up for this. This week the European Commission has presented its copyright reform for the European Union, and I wouldn't say that it is so much of a reform as it is a package of a new set of rules for special interests, and there are many problems with this package.
So these special interests, that would be media corporations, or what?
Mainly old-fashioned, old-time media, and also, of course, copyright holders, as per usual. The first thing is the link tax,
also called the Google tax.
Yeah. The rationale from the European Union side is that newspapers are in deep trouble nowadays, and they need money. And as people link to newspapers, people might make money on linking to them. And those revenues should be shared with the newspapers. Of course, this is quite backwards, because if I put a link on Facebook, for instance, I don't make any money on it, but the newspapers will get clicks and will get visitors. Mm. They tried this scheme in Spain, and they tried it in Germany, and it failed miserably. It resulted in the newspapers getting fewer readers.
Yeah.
So they tried it twice, and it was a disaster.
Many newspapers complained and said they didn't want the EU to meddle in this.
No. So now they are going to imply this scheme on the EU level for all of Europe.
Oh, God.
That might be a sign of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results.
But there are some protests against this that came only this week, isn't
there? Yeah, there are lots of protests. Everybody is furious. Of course, Google is furious, but also a lot of consumer organizations and privacy organizations and civil rights organizations, you name it. Everybody is upset about this. It's also a matter of the nervous system of the internet. Linking is it what makes the internet work. So like someone said, this might be like going after the links might be like if you took phone calls, and you couldn't get through. You always get this irritating beep, beep, beep when you try to call someone. Is what will happen if you hamper the link system.
Yeah, links are the internet, so to speak.
But there are many other things in this copyright package that is noteworthy. For instance, there might be a more intrusive filtering of content.
What kind of content? Well, or what platforms?
Yeah, for instance, YouTube. That's the most obvious one.
So user uploaded content will be more
exactly
filtered.
And a stricter copyright enforcement will end up in that everybody will have to filter and check all material that is being uploaded to the internet. And of course, that will be annoying, it will be difficult, and it will be very, very expensive.
So the companies running the services will have to check what each and every uploader uploads.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they can become liable for copyright infringement.
And they have to, so they will do this in some technical, algorithmical way, I guess.
Yeah. YouTube already has one of these models in place. It's not totally up to date when it comes to the new requirements, but we have all seen it, where videos are taken down because of copyright infringements, or where copyright owners try to get the revenues from material that other people has uploaded. Sometimes this doesn't work at all, and there are wrongful accusations of copyright infringement. But one thing that is very interesting is that even if, let's say, Google, YouTube, and maybe Facebook and some others can manage this, because it's obviously very expensive and very difficult. Let's say they can manage it. But what about new startups? What about new competition? What about new companies? They won't have the millions that it will cost them to develop and apply such a system.
Yeah, I saw that Julia Reda, the Pirate Party member of European Parliament, she mentioned that YouTube spent $60 million to develop their system to control what users upload automatically.
Yeah, exactly. So this would be a way to kill off competition from YouTube and Facebook, as well as protecting old media and old copyright holders.
Okay. Yeah, and the principle that everything that anyone in the EU uploads will be filtered. I mean, that's the implication, and that's not such a good thing to install, is it?
No. Everything you do will have to be inspected and evaluated, and they will have to pass some sort of judgment on it. So we will have a very intrusive censorship regime, actually, if this proposal is adopted. And then we have some other details. It was expected that the Commission was going to make a panorama exception, make it legal for people to take photographs of the public space, even though it might contain a statue or a building or something else that is copyright protected, but they didn't.
So they didn't include the good stuff that we were hoping for.
No.
Another thing is this geo-blocking thing that if you are a Netflix subscriber, for example, you won't be able to watch your movies if you go to another country. If you have an IP address from another country, right?
They are suggesting some reforms, but it's not really user beneficial. It's more for these companies that they can ease the geo-blocking in some minor ways. But there is still no change for ordinary people. If you go to another country, you cannot use your Netflix subscription, for instance. I mean, it's quite stupid because even if you travel, you can only use Netflix once. You can't use it multiple times at once. Even if you are in a different country, it's still your Netflix subscription, and it's still the films you want to see, and you don't use it more than you would have done if you would have been at home.
Yeah, okay. So it's the same amount of use.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that I want the EU to regulate this, because, I mean, wouldn't it be better if the company that offers, that everyone can see the movies, no matter which IP address they have, wouldn't such a company prosper and get more successful than the others? So it's a question of competition.
But this basically boils down to the fact that we have like 27 different copyright regimes in Europe. There is this different licensing for each and every country. So it's an underlying issue of licensing, and that also applies, for instance, to services like iTunes. It would be quite natural to have one common European market for music and films via iTunes, but that still will be compartmentalized in different markets for different countries. So I would say there's not really any reform on that point.
Okay, was there anything else in this package that you wanted to mention?
There's lots, but we'll get back to that.
Because in that case, I want to ask concretely, so this was a proposal from the European Commission that came only this week, right?
Yeah.
The day before yesterday, I think.
Now it's a real proposal. Earlier on it was impact assessments and such things. This is a real proposal. It will go to the Council, that is the member countries, and the Parliament, that is the European Parliament, and the people's elected representatives, and they have to agree on something on this. And I think there will be a major fight about that. We can make a clip with we can insert a YouTube movie here. A very short one, where you will hear members from in the European Parliament from all over the political field having their say very shortly about this. It's Marietje Schaake, liberal from the Netherlands, Julia Reda, pirate MEP from Germany, Dan Dalton, conservative from Britain, and Brando Benti, from Italy, who is a left-wing member.
Okay, and that is a campaign against this link tax.
Yeah, save the link.
Okay. It's 1 minute and 15 seconds, so let's listen to all their voices now.
The internet is like a big network of links, and it's essential for its functioning. Imagine it wouldn't connect anymore, just like every phone call you place going unanswered. How frustrating would that be? Well, the European Commission wants to add extra copyright to the links on the internet, and I think that would break it. You know that preview that shows up when you share a link on social media? Just a picture and a little bit of text? Well, that would be illegal, unless the news site is paid, and that for 20 years after the publication.
How we share and discuss the news is in danger. The plan would also harm European startups who can't possibly afford to pay. And it won't lead to more income for news sites, let alone for journalists, but instead to fewer links to European publications.
This idea already failed spectacularly both in Spain and Germany, but the European Commission is still considering pushing it through. So we joined forces as members from four different political groups across the party lines, also with different attitudes towards the European Commission, but joining forces against this attack on the freedom to leave. Are you with us?
All right. So what's the time frame for this, Hux?
Well, I think the Commission would like to get this done and over with within a year at least. But I think it will drag out in time. If the Commission and the... if the Council and the Parliament cannot agree... normally, the normal procedure is that the proposal should be sent back to the Commission to be rewritten, and then we should make another try, and if we can't agree on that, it goes back to the Commission again to be rewritten, and then back again for a third try to get it approved.
So it sounds like several years.
It can be several years, but nowadays... the European Parliament and the Council often meet in secret meetings, in so-called trialogues, where they make compromises behind closed doors settle on something instead of having this slow process. You can't know what deals they are making, but they will come out with a joint proposal, and if that happens, this can be done and over with within a year.
Oh, okay.
But I think there will be a major fight about this.
Mm. We didn't really introduce ourselves in the beginning, but we can mention that Hux worked in the European Parliament for the Swedish Pirate Party for 5 years between 2009 and 2014, right?
Yep.
Okay, so this was a proposal from the European Commission. And let's move on to the next subject, which is that the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, suggested that, or I don't know what kind of formality it was, but he suggested that every city in the EU should have open Wi-Fi networks in the city centers by 2020.
Well, yes, this was the State of the Union speech from Mr. Juncker. So it's no... no definite proposal, it's just something he said. But he said that he wanted free Wi-Fi in all city centers in Europe by 2020, and the deployment of 5G all over Europe for 2025.
But that's great, isn't it?
Now you have to be very careful, because of course it sounds great to have free Wi-Fi in every city center, but there might be problems with this. For instance, it's very unclear what set of rules that will apply. Today, cafes, restaurants, and other public places cannot offer public Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi, to their customers, because if the customers do some downloading or uploading or copyright infringement, whatever, then this cafe or restaurant can be liable for copyright infringement. And my first question when I hear Mr. Juncker's suggestion is what rules will apply to those cities who provide free Wi-Fi in their city centers? Are they not subject to the same copyright rules as, for instance, cafes and restaurants and private companies. And that needs to be settled out. Then we have the matter of what you see and what you don't see. If all cities in Europe will provide free Wi-Fi in their city centers, that will, of course, have consequences for commercial companies who are depending on paying customers to be able to do what Mr. Juncker wants them to do in his second point, that is to deploy the 5G network to 2025.
Okay, so you mean this is he's meddling in the free market where the EU shouldn't be?
Yeah, and of course, for ordinary people, it sounds great free Wi-Fi in city centers, but if you look at what Mr. Juncker says, there are conflicting messages. On the one side, free Wi-Fi; on the other side, he wants the telecoms companies to deploy 5G, to deploy 5G, they need to make money. How do they make money if Wi-Fi is for free? And then the third point that ought to be considered in all of this is exactly who is going to operate these free Wi-Fi networks, and what relation do that operator have to mass surveillance organizations like intelligence organizations, law enforcement agencies, and that is a wide open question. I mean, it would be Christmas for many police and intelligence organizations if there were to be open networks that they could listen into.
You know what I would like to see in all city centers in Europe?
Yeah.
Free toilets.
Yeah.
they have that in Japan at every metro station. I wish EU could regulate that. I mean, I don't think it's fair that people with smaller bladders have to pay a lot to go to the toilet when they're downtown.
Yeah, but those toilets in Japan, they are scary. Like, there are a lot of buttons and water and hot air coming from all directions.
That's why they're so wonderful. Anyway, let's move on. You mentioned that there is a campaign going on to pardon Snowden.
Yes.
Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, who is stuck in Moscow because no Western democracy wants to give him asylum, even though he has provided a great service to citizens of the free world, exposing mass surveillance. Now, Amnesty International and others, ACLU, for instance, well, many others, have started a campaign for President Obama to pardon Edward Snowden. The normal procedure is that an outgoing US president, one of his last actions is to pardon a number of people who are not supposed to be in jail, actually. Cases where it's not reasonable to lock people away, and of course Edward Snowden is not in jail, but he is. It's a fact that
he's wanted.
He is wanted, that his free movement is very limited. And I think that this should go for whistleblower Bradley or Chelsea Manning as well.
Yeah, definitely. But there are no campaigns for her?
Not yet, but I imagine that we will see such a campaign shortly.
And we can also mention that Julian Assange, who is at the Ecuadorian embassy in London and who is the founder of WikiLeaks, he will have his case tried by the Supreme Court of Sweden tomorrow.
Regional High Court.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, tomorrow Friday there will be a court hearing about his arrest case, warrant. Yeah. And of course, the arrest warrant is the reason that he has sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and so on and so on. We don't have to dig too deep in this today, but we can mention that the Swedish prosecutor has been under a tremendous lot of stress recently, as media has looked into why the case haven't moved forward. There might be some new developments at the end of this week. So, you went to a conference?
Yes, I went to Mozilla's View Source conference, the second of its kind. The first one was in Portland, USA, last year. And this year it was in Berlin, where we live.
Good evening, everyone! Guten Abend! Welcome to View Source 2016! Thank you so, so much for coming out for our first meeting. This is our second... Yeah.
Okay, so the Mozilla conference,
what was the scope? It was a conference for front-end developers, and that means people who are web developers, but who work not at the back end, but also not at the surface, because at the surface you have the designers.
Yeah.
So it's sort of the middle. Front-end developers, they can manage both design and coding.
Okay.
And it's very interesting because it's sort of almost a new niche that designers who were previously only designers are now learning to code, and coders who were pure coders are learning design. So it's sort of this... mix that this conference was, and and that makes for a very exciting mix, very interesting people. So there were lots of talks, and I think that from our point of view at the 5th of July Foundation, there were also some interesting privacy aspects.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed some people that I thought could who worked in that area. But before we listen to them, I would also like to mention that, this was a conference for people who love the web and who create the web. And the web has been, it has been declared dead so many times recently. my feeling after this conference is that it was like the rebirth of the web. For example, apps were for a long time a threat to the web, right? Because everyone used apps on their mobile devices. But what's happening now with progressive web apps is that everything that apps did before can now be made on the web. So you can get through the help of so-called service workers. I think our listeners know much more about this than I do. you can manage to get push notifications with these progressive web apps, which is very exciting. I can see how we can use that for the services that we run here at the foundation, for example.
So you mean like on my blog, hacks.5july.org, we can have push notifications?
Well, I don't really know if there's maybe, but I was rather thinking about we're running this disposable email service called Flashbox, and there we could run that as a progressive web app, for example, and give the users push notifications when a new email arrives, something like that. For me as a CSS person, meaning I can do beautiful design, but I can't code. I can't even code in JavaScript. So for me, this conference, I could benefit from about half of the talks, and the other halves were, they were a bit hard. I realized I have to learn JavaScript, but a few takeaways for people who are in this business would be that many of the speakers said that frameworks, CSS frameworks, are going away big time. And a framework that is something like Bootstrap, for example, that gives you a set of pre-designed buttons and grid layouts and so on. And that's very good news because they take up a lot of data when they are loaded. And also JavaScript libraries like jQuery, you don't have to use them if you only use JavaScript at one single place on your page, because that also, it loads a lot of redundant information that you don't need. Yeah, so stuff like that. And the more security-minded speakers said that very, very, very soon, all the web will be HTTPS, that is encrypted connection, which is also very good. Chrome will soon, the web browser Chrome from Google will very soon warn when you go to a site that is not HTTPS. So, So let's continue to the interviews that I made. We will start with Amy Elliott, who is design director at Simply Secure. She will explain what that is.
We are a nonprofit that does open research and consulting. So over the past year, we've been working to contribute non-code resources to help people protect their privacy. So some examples of that would be things like guides for how to do user studies with vulnerable populations. And we've had kind of two main constituencies. One group is UX designers who often aren't aware of some of the privacy and security implications of their work. So we're working on education and outreach to help designers get smarter about security. And then another main group is developers, cryptographers, technical people, and helping them understand more about human-centered design and UX.
So you're saying that UX designers, user interface designers, they are frequently not so aware about privacy issues?
Yes, I think that that's true. And if I think about my own professional background, prior to joining Simply Secure last year, I worked at IDEO, a design consultancy, as a researcher on projects for global 500 companies. And as a researcher, a lot of the tools and methods that I pursued to try to make the web better contributed to the whole ecosystem of tracking online behavior. My intents were good to help people get the experiences that they wanted, and I was very enthusiastic about website metrics, combining qualitative and quantitative research, and it was a big shock for me personally and professionally to understand that there are negative consequences of so much like online behavior tracking.
And how did this... is it a non-profit organization? How did it come about? Why was it started and by who?
So our founder is Meredith Whitaker, who's been head of open source at Google. And our executive director is Sarah Sinclair Brody. And together with a great group of advisors, they've helped see a gap in the world around what might be called usable security. And we've expanded our mission a bit beyond a focus specifically on security to thinking about more general questions of transparency and ethics. So our point of view is that everyone deserves to communicate privately and securely. And that means that secure communications shouldn't be a niche product, like only accessible to some people. We're looking for things that are appropriate for a mass audience and a global audience.
And in that, you are a design director, does that mean that your focus is how important the design is in this process to spread the security and privacy to the masses, or?
Yes. So I believe that design, user experience design, is a powerful tool for change. And I am interested to help designers that are professional employees at big companies, designers who are staff members in the internet freedom space, or even people that are volunteering. I want to help these designers protect people's privacy. And I mean, one really simple example is around things like password recovery flows. I think that some elements of security have traditionally been seen as off-putting, or if you're not very technical, there's nothing you can do about it. And I'm trying to encourage people to think about how even copywriting, even the words that they're using on screen, can help make a difference.
Okay, that's wonderful. And how come that you are based or partly based in Berlin?
Well, we are a virtual organization, and when I was in San Francisco, I was working virtually with our group, and I wanted to take advantage of that flexibility to join a community in Berlin. And I think the thinking on that is both that compared to San Francisco, I think Berlin has a very different point of view around the role of, you know, governments, corporations, the public in terms of shaping new technologies. And I wanted to make sure that I understood that perspective and could learn from it. But also, we really are interested in the world, and there's a benefit of same time zone for real-time collaboration, also with Middle East, Africa, places that, especially from the west coast of the United States, it can be difficult to like form these new relationships.
Yeah, that was almost a bit along the lines what you usually say, Hux, that yeah. It's hard to be secure when you're untechnical.
Yeah, exactly. And I find it very hopeful if tech-savvy people and then people who are into security, we will adapt a more user-friendly approach. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the major problems in the internet today, that there are some pretty good secure solutions, but people don't understand how to use them. If we can move forward on that point, it would be great.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting that this Simply Secure organization and our organization, 5th of July Foundation, they sort of want to do a bit the same thing. They want to spread security to the masses through guides and so on. The people behind our foundation, they are sort of internet veterans, people who don't even use Google services, or try not to, at least. I mean, you and I, we are not so extreme, but the founders are. Whereas the people behind Simply Secure, they even come from Google. Yeah. So I think that's interesting. They sort of come from big business.
Yeah. As I mentioned before, I got some quite mixed impressions about Google, because they are doing a lot of good as well.
Mm.
And of course they are invading our privacy as well, but they are doing some good things.
They have the potential to do many bad things.
Yeah.
But that's not really their fault. It's just that they happen to be the leader. Okay, let's move on to the next interview. This is with Potch, who was the moderator of the conference and who is also a developer activist at Mozilla.
Hi, I'm Matt Claypotch. I do developer relations for Mozilla. I've been a web developer / developer relations person there for about 6 years.
Okay, and tell me a bit about how Mozilla works with privacy, because privacy is a big thing for Mozilla, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, we really want users to have the most control possible over their data when they're online. And that shows up sort of in our products. You know, Firefox, like other browsers, offers the ability to synchronize history and bookmarks between various devices. So if you're signed in over here and you're signed in over here, you can share your history, bookmarks, and even what tabs you have open. But we do that in a way where what's stored on our server is completely encrypted, and only on either end is it decrypted. So we never have access to the individual data. We don't want access to it. You know, we don't want to be able to, you don't want to be a target for a subpoena or a government request, and we don't want our users to fear that we are sort of a weak third link that might give people access to their data. So
what happens if you get a subpoena from the government and they want some data about your users?
In general, we don't really even have a solid way to disambiguate between which user's data is which. So you sort of get the whole blob of, we could say, well, here's all of our users' data. We don't know who's whose, and they're all individually encrypted with keys we don't know. So it's really, while we have the data in a form, there's no way of knowing, you know, which user's which, and actually, even with if you could figure out which user's which, what key that individual user's been encrypted with, because that key is based on their password. It's such information that we never possess and don't want to possess.
Okay, so you're not in the business of collecting data about the users, which most companies are nowadays.
No, we are not in the business of collecting data. We collect only the minimum amount of data we need to do our job. You know, you can voluntarily say, I want to, you know, provide some usage statistics to us, but it's opt-in, and the user has, you know, gets to read a doc, can go on and read more about what we're going to do with that data. Really, we just need the like very basics of, did Firefox crash and why? And we make sure that when we collect that data, it's done in a way where any person identifying aspects of it are go away in 90 days and have the highest clearance people can sort of read any person identifying. So for instance, if say Firefox crashes, the page that the user was on when it crashed is treated as sensitive as a password. We store it, and only people who absolutely need to know that information can have it, and we dispose of that data as quickly as possible, only until we can diagnose a crash. We don't want that data laying around where someone could ask for it.
Wow, I always wondered that. Sometimes I provide the page if I, yeah. So anyway, one last question. It's a bit of a stupid question, but Mozilla is a foundation, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's sort of a confusing structure. Mozilla is the foundation, which is a 501(c), a nonprofit in the US, purely public benefit organization. And we have what's called the Mozilla Corporation, which you may see that occasionally. And that's sort of for paying taxes for, you know, all the employees. But the corporation's entirely owned by the foundation, and the governance of the organization is within the nonprofit. The corporation really only exists as sort of a tax-paying entity, because, you know, paying a couple hundred engineers takes, you know, incurs a little bit of tax. But in general, we are a completely nonprofit organization.
Okay, so here's a stupid question. Maybe I will cut it out. But how do you make money? What's the main means of making money for Mozilla?
In general, we make our money with partnerships. So in particular, search. When you download and install Firefox, there's a default search engine built into the browser. That search traffic is worth a lot of money to the search engine. And so by being the default, we get a small percentage of that. It winds up being, you know, it might be billions of dollars worth of traffic to the search engine, and our small percentage is more than enough for the organization to continue to run. That said, we are very, very comfortable with and want to make it as easy as possible for the user to switch to a search engine that they choose. But in general, a lot of people just don't choose to change their default. And so we have more than enough users using the default search engine to make that relationship keep us in business.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Nice to meet you.
Any comments, Hux?
That sounds very hopeful.
Makes you like Mozilla, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I already do like this when I'm at my computer, that I have the Chrome browser for everything Google-related, you know. Everything is intertwined and connected to each other. Everything that is googly, I use mm-hmm. on Chrome. But important stuff like some of my webmail, banking, work-related stuff, I always do on Mozilla Firefox.
Okay.
And then, of course, I have a Tor browser as well. It sounds this is a secure secure solution from what we just heard.
Mm. Yeah, they have
using Firefox.
They definitely have a very nice attitude, at least.
Yeah.
So the last longer interview is with Bas Timmers, who is a Dutch guy living in Berlin and working on a consultancy, which is sort of, it has some relevance to our topics as well.
My name is Bas Timmers. I'm the managing director of Neue Signale, which is a consultancy agency for small and medium-sized enterprises in the area of digital innovation.
Okay, and are you also involved in this freeyourdata.org thing?
No, that's actually an idea of Ali Yelve. He has his own company called ProtoNet. They have private servers, and data security is a very important subject for them. So that's why they came up with the freeyourdata.org movement. I know Ali because I wrote an essay about the same topic, and when you do your research, then you automatically will see that Ali is doing something in that area as well.
Okay, and in this consulting, Neue Signale, you are focused on sort of the middle segment of companies, or?
If you mean mid-sized companies, definitely. We're not interested in the big corporates because you've got McKinsey, McCann, and the big consulting firms for that. But in Germany, middle-sized firms, so let's say from 50 employees on, are a big part of the economy, and they're not very well served by consultancy agencies, and there is a lot of work to be done in the area of, you know, innovation and digital transformation, and that's where we focus on.
Okay, so what do they need help with typically?
Well, the problems are very, very, very wide ranging. So it can be about business models. It can be about product development. You know, there's the old-fashioned way of developing products over a period of 2 years doesn't work. You've got rapid prototyping nowadays. You've got design thinking, stuff like that. Online marketing can be an issue because they have no idea that advertising in newspapers and magazines doesn't work anymore, but how do you actually create an ad for Facebook and stuff like that? So it's a wide range of subjects that we try to help these entrepreneurs with.
Are you inspired by Jaron Lanier? Because you mentioned him in your talk, and he also talks about this disappearance of the middle class, or the Mittelstand, or what do you call it?
They call it Mittelstand here. I'm absolutely inspired by him because I think in general he's right. You see, since the age of, let's say, Facebook and Amazon and a lot of other big companies, you see that monopolies are arising and winner takes all. So the winners take all the big money, and the wealth distribution from that is actually very, very unequal. So in the, let's say, old age, there was a huge middle class because you would have like a lot of middle management in factories and stuff like that who would still get a proper wage. That has disappeared in the digital economy. So you will see that the top 2% at a company like Facebook is getting a disproportionate amount of money, and the other 98% do not. And this, in the long term, will cause a lot of problems. That's one side of it. The other side of it is that a lot of users of services like Facebook and Google do not get anything in compensation for their thoughts, pictures, and videos that they are uploading. And that's not fair as well in the end.
Well, in that case, it sounds like your consultancy basically goes really along the lines of, what was it called, his book, Who Owns the Future?
Definitely, though. The topic of wealth distribution is, you know, very far away from what we do in everyday life, because entrepreneurs in small and medium-sized companies just want to know, how do I make money? How do I survive in the next year? How do I get into the digital era? The whole topic of wealth distribution and how do you manage data in a digital era is something of, I'd almost say, like a hobby. Or something that we consider to be very, very important, you know, privacy, data security in the digital age, and something that we want to push forward personally and with Neue Signale as well.
But how does this data security come into your consultancy? Because it doesn't necessarily have to be about protecting data, does it?
Absolutely. I think data security and thinking about data is a basic requirement for every firm. It's not something, it's not like a typical topic that we would bring up straight away when we're getting to know a customer. It's more something like, I mean, if you are moving into the direction of digital business models, please think about this as well. Do you really want to store data of your customers on your own servers, or do you want to create a world in a slightly different way?
Okay, but in that case, there's a charity aspect, or is this about that they actually can make more money if they care about their customers' data in a better way?
My opinion on that is that in the end, if you treat your customers fair, you will always make more money in the end, because you're being transparent and you're fair to all sides. So you're fair to your own employees and you're also fair to the customers. The owners of Google are probably going to say something different, although they are doing their own fair share, you know, for the common good as well, and stuff like that. So I think in the end, if you take care of your customers in a fair way, everyone will benefit from that.
I think that the little I've heard from this conference, it gives me a very positive picture about the future.
Mm. These were, I mean, Potts was the moderator, and the other two interviews, they were part of the Ignite talks the first evening. So it was not really central to the conference, but it was in it. I was especially excited by the fact that he was inspired by Jaron Lanier. Have you read his book, Who Owns the Future?
No, I haven't.
Which is a book which is, it's pretty theoretical, but it makes a very good analysis of the current state, where this middle section of companies and all the layers or hedges, or I forgot what he calls them, are disappearing, and how, how all money are aggregated to a very small company like Instagram with 13 employees and so on. So it was... I think he's doing a very interesting thing. So lastly, I want to play a short interview from the first night, where I met two very young guys. They might have been the youngest attendees at the conference. So let's hear what they said.
My name is Christian.
Do you care about privacy on internet?
Yes, I do. But I may do it different than other people, and not that I use some very special tools, but I have some different opinion than most people.
In which way?
A lot of people tend to say either they use it a lot and put a lot of also useless things on it, and then there's the other side that says it's bad. And I'm the one that says, pick the good parts of both. Just use it for, and only use it when it makes sense and when you have something you want to share, which really comes from your heart, which has some. I don't know how to say it.
Why are you at this conference?
Because I want to get a web developer and I want to get involved, and this is my first real opportunity to meet real people that do, in my opinion, absolutely amazing things.
And how old are you?
I'm 16.
And what about you? What's your name?
My name is Matthias Klevetter.
And what do you think about privacy on the internet?
I care not that much about privacy for myself, because I think I have to present myself, to market myself, and the only way to do it, the best way to do it, is over social media. So I have to show myself and make a lot of ads. Advertising for myself.
Which social media do you use?
I use Twitter, Facebook, A lot of WhatsApp, Instagram, Snapchat.
And why are you at this conference?
Because I want to listen to the people who have experience and because I want to meet new people.
And how old are you?
I'm 16.
So you are both 16. I thought you studied at the university, but obviously you must be in high school then. Are you?
No, I do not study yet. Yeah, but it's nice you thought I do.
Yeah, so these guys use social media in the same way as you do, Hux, as advertisement.
Yeah, and I guess the first one wasn't really into Grumpy Cat and all that.
Okay.
Nice bonus material to hear people talking about the future, young people talking about the future.
Yeah, especially since I didn't even think young people used the web anymore. I thought internet means Facebook. I mean, we have discussed that in previous episodes, and these young people and everyone at the conference really give hope for the future.
But as we mentioned before, we might be in an era where the development takes us back to the web. Because if you think of it, most things that an app can do can be done on a web page.
Mm-hmm. Especially with progressive web apps.
Exactly. Yeah. And adaptive design. Why do an app that can't run on the web?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't make something on the web that also can run on smartphones and tablets?
Yeah.
That's hopeful.
You are impatient now.
maybe we should round this up and say a few words about the podcast. you must excuse us for our Swenglish. This is our first podcast in English, and the reason that we did it in English is, of course, that we had all these interviews about the conference, mm-hmm. and people who attended the conference wanted to hear the podcast, and etc., etc. But please give us comments. Can you bear us talking Swenglish?
Think? I mean, if you liked it, please comment. And I would say that all relevant links, because Hux writes a blog in English. But all relevant links will, I mean, you found this podcast, so you will also see the list of links. The main URL to our foundation is 5july.org, and that's the digit 5 followed by july.org.
How about that? And my blog is hux.5july.org.
Hux, H-A-S? What do you mean? Yeah.
Hux, that is...
Your name is... Yeah, exactly. It's not like Huxley. It's more like Hax.
Yeah.
H-A-X. And follow
it's
Hux.
It's too complicated to...
Follow Hux on Twitter, which is H-A-X.
Yeah.
The Twitter nick you can get if you register in April 2007.
Yeah.
And with that, thank you for today, and come back next week if you want to.
Au revoir.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.